pretty sure this podium is going to fall apart while I stand here. That's great. The whole thing is just coming apart. Okay. Sorry, technical difficulties. 1 Samuel 31. Now the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell down, slain in Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines followed hard upon Saul and upon his sons. And the Philistines slew Jonathan and Abinadab and Malchishua, Saul's sons. And the battle went sore against Saul, and the archers hit him, and he was sore wounded of the archers. Then said Saul unto his armor bearer, Draw thy sword and thrust me through therewith, lest these uncircumcised come and thrust me through and abuse me. But his armor bearer would not, for he was sore afraid. Therefore Saul took a sword and fell upon it. And when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he fell likewise upon his sword and died with him. So Saul died, and there and his three sons, and his armor bearer, and all his men that same day together. And when the men of Israel that were on the other side of the valley, and they that were on the other side Jordan, saw that the men of Israel fled, and that Saul and his sons were dead, they forsook the cities and fled, and the Philistines came and dwelt in them. And it came to pass on the morrow, when the Philistines came to strip the slain, that they found Saul and his three sons fallen in Mount Gilboa. And they cut off his head and stripped off his armor and sent it into the land of the Philistines round about to publish it in the house of their idols and among the people. And they put his armor bearer in the house of Ashtaroth, and they fastened his body to the wall of Bethshan. And when the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead heard of that which the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men arose and went all night and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons from the wall of Bethshan, and came to Jabesh, and burnt them there. And they took their bones and buried them under a tree at Jabesh, and fasted 7 days. So we'll turn it over to our brother Jason Robinson of the Thousand Oaks Ecclesia. His first class is entitled The Feeble King. Brother Jason.
Is this podium going to be okay? Okay. Just my Bible, it's all right. Yeah, exactly. All right, well, good morning, my dear brothers and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ. It is very exciting that my sister wife and I could be here joining you guys this weekend. And of course, I bring with me the love of your brothers and sisters and your fellow CYCers in warm but somewhat parched and scorched Southern California. In our CYC, we have a handful of members who have actually ventured out here for Camp Lador, and they return only saying great things about your weekend out here. That and concussions, I guess, in snow tackle football or something like that, a version of football we don't often play in Southern California. All right, so the topic for the weekend, the headless of 1 Samuel. And I actually had a few brothers and sisters approach me in the past couple months saying that they saw this in their newsletters. The recording brother would announce it from the podium, and they said, I'm terribly sorry, Jason, but I think that our recording brother accidentally said the wrong title for your series. They said Headless of 1 Samuel, and can you believe that? And I said, actually, it is. And I'm not a very clever title maker for my series, so I couldn't just get past something as boring as the Headless of 1 Samuel. But what we hope to go over this weekend is we hope to look at the mind of Christ. And we'll be taking a look at the mind of Christ by looking, really, at opposite characters. And we're going to see what the wrong people do for our first three classes this morning, and then by means of Sunday school tomorrow, we'll take a look at the mind of Christ in those three stories, And then by means of exhortation, of course, we'll look into our own minds for the emblems. So our first topic for today, as mentioned already, is the feeble king. And we've seen in 1 Samuel 31, perhaps the first beheading that we'll be taking a look at, and that was of the feeble king Saul. And it's in 1 Samuel 31. They cut off his head, the Philistines do, in verse 9. They cut off his head, they stripped off his armor, and they sent into the land of the Philistines roundabout to publish it in the house of their idols and among the people. So what we'll be taking a look at this weekend is three individuals in the book of 1 Samuel, each of which literally lose their head. And we'll be taking a look at what transpired in their life, what made them who they were, and what made the scriptures say their heads don't belong to them anymore. We'll remove it. So before we do that, though, we kind of have to get some context. What's important about the headless? Why do we focus so much on the head? And if you'll come back with me to a very familiar verse to us in Genesis chapter 3 and a verse 15. Genesis chapter 3, and at the 15th verse, we have the curse that was given in the Garden of Eden. Eve partakes of the fruit. Adam partakes of the fruit, and the angel comes to Adam, and he says, have you eaten of the fruit that I commanded you not to? And what does Adam say? Well, the woman that you gave me, she convinced me to eat of the fruit. And the angel comes to Eve and says, did you eat of the fruit that I told you not to? And she says, well, the serpent did. And the serpent has no one to blame, so the first curse belongs to the serpent in verse 15, where God says, and I will put enmity between thee and the woman, between thy seed and her seed. It shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel. So this theme of bruising the head runs throughout all of Scripture. And after this very first sin, in the very first few chapters of Scripture, this thinking of the serpent seems to slither its way through every single page until you get to the very end. And here we are at this conference, and this thinking of the serpent still has the ability to affect our thinking. And so we come to Genesis 3, verse 15. But let's take a look again at really what Eve saw in this fruit. If you come with me to Genesis 3, just a few verses back to verse 6. And some of you guys probably already have this marked. It says in Genesis 3, verse 6, and when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree to be desired to make one wise, she took of the fruit thereof and did eat, and gave also to her husband with her, and he did eat. Now you have those three aspects. Does anybody have in their margin marked what those three aspects link to? It's in the writing of John. Does anybody have that note in their margin? It's three things, yeah. Absolutely right. So you have the three aspects of sin, right? John tells us in 1 John 2:16, if you don't have that marked, that there's three things that make up all the evil. Everything evil is made up of three individual things: the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life. And that's what the serpent uses to entice Eve to partake of the fruit. And so when God brings a curse upon the serpent, he's saying, I'm going to crush your head. Every thinking that you have will one day be removed. And so if we come back to 1 Samuel chapter 31, we'll use as an example for our first topic this morning, feeble King Saul. Most definitely affected by the thinking of the serpent all throughout his life. And what we're going to actually look into a little bit this morning for our first topic is the thinking of King Saul. Now we know he's fighting the Philistines, and his army is absolutely getting destroyed by the Philistines. There's many of them slain, and they look up to their king for help, and they see on Mount Gilboa, well, Saul's three sons are dead, laying right around him. And they see Saul, arrows sticking out of him, every which way. And they see that there's a sword sticking out of his back. And they realize that this mighty king whom they've chosen as their king of the nation lays dead before them. But this is the end of his story. Let's take a look at the beginning of his story, if you will, in 1 Samuel chapter 8. And while you turn to 1 Samuel chapter 8, I'm going to read you the state of the nation of Israel at this time. It's the very last verse of the book of Judges. The very last book of the Judges says, "In those days, there was no king in Israel." Was that true? Who was their king? God was, right, wasn't he? But it says, "In those days, there was no king, and did that which was right in his own eyes." So you come now to 1 Samuel chapter 8. And we see that it came to pass, verse 1, when Samuel was old, that he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn was Joel, the name of his second, Abiah. They were judges in Beersheba. So they followed after the example, really, of their father Samuel. Judges had ruled the land, mostly good judges, in the land of Israel. They come to Samuel, an amazing judge. And then Samuel has two sons. Not so amazing. It says, "And his sons walked not in his ways, but turned aside after lucre and took bribes and perverted judgment. Then all the elders of Israel gathered themselves together and came to Samuel, and they said, 'We can't stand your sons any longer.'" And what do they ask for? They said in verse 5, "You're old, Samuel, and your sons, they don't walk in your ways. Now, they say, make us a king. Give us a king, Samuel. We need a king." But what was the reason? "We want to be like the other nations. We desire to be like the nations." We read in Judges that there was no king in Israel. There was a king. God was their king. And you know what's interesting? Is God actually wanted a king in Israel. Genesis chapter 49, you don't have to turn there, but this is the record of Israel blessing his sons. And he says of the tribe of Judah, Genesis 49, verse 8, "Judah, thou art he whom thy brethren shall praise. Thy hand shall be in the neck of thine enemies. Thy father's children shall bow down before thee. The scepter," verse 10, "shall not depart from Judah," he says. So God said, "I want a king in Israel." But he hadn't finished preparing the man whom he had chosen. And we know who that man was, from the tribe of Judah, the righteous king, the man after God's own heart, King David. But David had some preparations that he had to go through in his life in order to be set up as a king. And so the people, they jump the gun and they say, "We need a king because we want to look like all the nations in the world. That's what we want to look like. Because we're doing that which is right in our own eyes." And they choose the perfect king, don't they, for what they desire. Let's look at verse 2, right across the page in chapter 9. "And this man, Kish, had a son whose name was Saul. A choice young man and goodly." But it doesn't stop there. We already know from this chapter and this verse 2, Saul was a handsome bloke in Israel. Well, this exactly fits with what the nation of Israel craves in a king, isn't it? Oh, man, we want a king that will make us look like the nations. Someone we can look up to. Someone we can march into battle right behind. But it goes on. It says, "There was not among the children of Israel a goodlier person than he." The most handsome man in all of Israel was this man named Saul. And it's almost as if God was saying, "You want a king, Israel? I'll give you a king." From his shoulders and up, he was higher than any of the people. Now, if you were the nation of Israel, and you were looking around, and you were scanning everybody, you said, "Oh, we need a king." And you're looking, and "Oh, man, look at that guy. That's a king we can follow," they said. And so they choose Saul. And Saul starts his reign off decently, doesn't he? Turn over the page to 1 Samuel chapter 11. They've chosen a king that they can look up to, literally, a king they can follow into battle, and they say, this is it, we're Israel, we're like the nations around us. Israel was sick of having God as their king. They wanted a king that they could see. So we come to 1 Samuel chapter 11. And it's a decent introduction to Saul's campaigns. Then Nahash the Ammonite came up and encamped against this group of people in Jabesh-Gilead. Verse 1. And all the men of Jabesh said unto Nahash, make a covenant with us and we will serve thee. So you have this wicked man, Nahash, and he marches towards this little land called Jabesh-Gilead. And the people of Jabesh-Gilead say, whoa, hang on a second. Don't kill us, please. Instead, we'll make a covenant with you. And Nahash the Ammonite answered them, and he says, well, that doesn't sound too bad. On this condition, will I make a covenant with you? I'm going to take out your right eyes. That's the deal. If you want to make a covenant with me and me not slay every single one of you, I'm going to remove your right eyes out of your heads and lay it up for reproach upon Israel. And the elders of Jabesh said unto him, give us 7 days, they said. Wait 7 days, and we'll let you know if we accept this offer. Meanwhile, we're going to look for somebody to help us out. Then came the messengers of Gibeah of Saul, verse 4, and told the tidings in the ears of the people, and all the people lifted up their voices and wept. And behold, Saul came after the herd out of the field, and Saul said, what aileth the people that they weep? And they told him the tidings of the people of Jabesh. And the Spirit of God came upon Saul when he heard those tidings, and his anger was kindled greatly. But notice what it says at the very, very beginning of verse 6. The Spirit of God came upon Saul. That's vital. That's what made Saul the man he's going to be here in this chapter. The Spirit of God. Because you know that Spirit leaves him, as we'll look in a few seconds. So what does he do? Well, he takes a yoke of oxen. And the story probably sounds familiar. He chops the yoke of oxen up into all these little pieces, and he sends it to every household in Israel and Judah. And he says, look, if you guys don't come and help, we're going to do this very same thing to your oxen. Do you think he got a good response? Of course he did. And when he numbered them in Bezek, verse 8, the children of Israel were 300,000, the men of Judah 30,000. And they sent, and they said unto the messengers that came, thus shall ye say to the men of Jabesh-Gilead, tomorrow, by the time the sun is hot, ye shall have help. And the messengers came and showed to the men of Jabesh, and they were glad. They were going to keep their right eyes. But it's interesting. Do you know what the word Nahash is in Hebrew? And I'm sure some of you have this marked. What's the word Nahash in Hebrew? We've looked at it before. It's the same exact word as serpent in Genesis chapter 3. That's the Hebrew word. When you're reading in Genesis chapter 3, it says, and the Nahash beguiled Eve. That's the word. So you come here to chapter 11, verse 1. Then the serpent, the Ammonite, came up and encamped against Jabesh-Gilead, and the men of Jabesh-Gilead said, we'll make a covenant with you, serpent. That's what we want to do. We want to make a covenant with you so you don't kill us. And Saul says, you're not going to make a covenant with the serpent. You're not going to do that. And he delivers the people of Jabesh-Gilead. And he saves them. He delivers them from this group of Ammonites. Verse 11, and it was so on the morrow that Saul put the people in three companies. And they came into the midst of the host in the morning watch and slew the Ammonites until the heat of the day. And it came to pass that they which remained were scattered, so that two of them were not left together. And what do you think the people thought about their king now? Samuel, you doubted this man? Look at what they say in verse 12. And the people said unto Samuel, who is he that said, shall Saul reign over us? Bring the men that we may put them to death. And Saul said, there shall not a man be put to death this day, for today Yahweh hath wrought salvation in Israel. You know what? He was exactly right. Because verse 6 says, the Spirit of God came upon Saul. But unfortunately, it didn't last too long. 1 Samuel 16, I'll go ahead and I'll read it. 1 Samuel 16, verse 14. But the Spirit of Yahweh departed from Saul. And it says, there was an evil spirit from Yahweh that troubled him. So you have this Spirit of Yahweh come upon Saul, and it affects his mind. He says, Yahweh gave you deliverance. And in chapter 16, that spirit leaves, and we're told it comes upon someone completely different. Who did it come upon? King David. That's the man who Yahweh chose to be king of the tribe of Judah. The scepter would never depart from the tribe of Judah. And it comes and it rests upon David. And in its place, King Saul had an evil spirit. And that's what was in his mind. An evil spirit slithered its way into his head. And we know that this evil spirit sticks with him really for the rest of his life. What does he do right before his final battle? He visits a witch. And he goes to the witch and he says, am I going to win this battle tomorrow? Now, why would he go to the witch? Why didn't he go to the Heavenly Father? He tried. But that was like the first time he had tried in like forever. As a last resort, he went to Yahweh. Brothers and sisters, young people, where was Saul's mind? Was it on the things above? Absolutely not. It was on the things of the thinking of the serpent. And so if you were to say, well, Saul, this mighty king, on what grounds was he chosen as king? Well, the children of Israel did that which was right in their own eyes. They wanted to really look like the nations. And what kind of king did they choose? The most handsome man they could find, who in fact was a head and shoulders taller than every other individual. So if you were to narrow down and say, well, one of these types of sin really emulates this character, which one would it have to be? It'd be the lust of the eyes, wouldn't it? The lust of the eyes. The entire nation of Israel said, we see these nations around us. We want to look like that. We want a king that we can see. Did they choose a fitting king for that? Of course they did. They could see him from anywhere. And when they saw him, he was the goodliest man in all of Israel. But that didn't make his mind the best mind in Israel. So come with me, if you will, now to 1 Samuel 31 one more time. Let's find out what happens to King Saul. Now, do you remember, on what grounds did the people of Israel choose Saul? They said two things. We want a man to go before us and lead us into battle. And we also choose Saul because he's the goodliest and the tallest. Well, by the time the battle is over, they'll have no king to lead them into battle. And guess what will happen to their king? He's going to be the same height as everybody else. And he's going to be probably one of the ugliest. So we come to verse 7. And the men of Israel that were on the other side of the valley, and they that were on the other side Jordan, saw that the men of Israel fled, and that Saul and his sons were dead. They forsook the cities, and they fled, and the Philistines came, and they dwelt in them. And it came to pass on the next day, a pretty abnormally decent move by the Philistines to wait a day before they spoiled the bodies. When the Philistines came to strip the slain, they found Saul and his three sons fallen in Mount Gilboa. And Saul, arrows sticking into him, had committed suicide by falling on his sword, basically lying face down in the dirt. This was the mighty king of Israel. So what did they do? Verse 9. They cut off his head. They strip off his armor. And they sent into the land of the Philistines round about to publish it in the house of their idols and among the people. And we're told, interestingly enough, that they put his armor in the house of Ashtaroth, and they fastened his body to a wall at Beth Shan. Let's go the other way. Now, on this hill that you see on the slide, not below the mountain, but on the top, was this little area called Beth Shan. Oh my goodness. Here is a better picture of the top. So here's what the top of the mountain looks like. And this is Beth Shan. They've recently kind of uncovered some of the pieces there. But this is where Saul's body was hung. And I'm purposely going to go this way, just so we kind of get a picture. When you're walking through the land of the Philistines, on top of this mountain was basically what you could call downtown Beth Shan. This was the place. This was the place to be in this time period. And so what do they do with his body? Well, it says they fastened his body to the wall of Beth Shan. What that actually means is gory, but they would have this long protruding spear attached to the wall. And they would just stick it up on there. And they would do that with all these kings that they would conquer. And you would walk through Beth Shan and you would see, wow, look at our mighty nation. Look at who we conquered, this person and this king and this nation. And then there was Saul, a little bit taller than the rest of the kings, perhaps, without a head, without his armor, which he trusted on, by the way, as we'll see in a further class. He trusted in his armor so valiantly. They put his armor in the house of Ashtaroth, one of their gods. And we don't find it here. We actually find it in 1 Chronicles 10. You don't have to turn there. The parallel account to the story where Saul is defeated and beheaded, they put his head somewhere special. They put his head in the house of Dagon. Who's Dagon? Dagon was one of the mighty gods in the land of Philistia. Dagon was the god of fertility. Like, they needed more of those. And so Dagon represented everything to these people. Every success that they had, as we'll find out in our next class, they attributed to mighty Dagon. And so where would the most valuable plunder go? Of course, in the temple of Dagon. And that's where they put his head. Isn't it beautiful, brothers and sisters, that that's where Saul's head ended up? That's what his whole life was about. It wasn't focused on the things of Yahweh. His life was focused on the things that were against Yahweh. His armor is in the house of Ashtaroth, his body is in Beth Shan, and his head's in the temple of Dagon. And he is spread out over all the land of the Philistines. But look at verse 11 in 1 Samuel 31. You recognize these characters, don't you? And when the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead heard of that which the Philistines had done to Saul, who were the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead? Well, those are the people that Saul saved in his first magnificent job as a king. He saves the men of Jabesh-Gilead. And these people, they hear about what's happened to Saul. And look what they do in verse 12. And all the valiant men arose. They went all night, it says. And they took the body of Saul, and they reached up onto these stakes in the wall, and they slid his body off in the dead of night. In downtown Bethshan, they did this. And they took the bodies of his sons from the wall of Bethshan and came to Jabesh and burnt them there. And they took their bones and they buried them under a tree at Jabesh and fasted 7 days. So these men of Jabesh Gilead, what do they bring back to Israel? His head? His armor? Just his body. They just bring back the body. In fact, they take the body and they end up burning it. His head stays in the temple of Dagon. His armor, with Ashtaroth, the idol. And this mighty king, whom they had chosen years before, how did he end up? Exactly like everybody else. The same individual, like everybody else in Israel. Just as tall. No head. An interesting end to King Saul. And so, as we progress this morning, and you were to say, well, Saul's life can be summarized by one thing. Of course, he suffered from the pride of life, didn't he? And you can name countless times. The lust of the flesh, that was Saul as well. But in fact, from the very beginning to the very end of Saul's life, it seems that the lust of the eyes controlled him. And it controlled people's views of him. And it really epitomized his kingship in the land of Israel. And so as we progress this morning, we've looked at our first beheading in 1 Samuel, which is actually the last. And what we're going to do is we're now going to move backwards. In our second class, we're going to take a look at another. And in our third class, we'll take a look at the first. And we're going to work our way backwards for our series because the end is so beautiful. The end is just absolutely perfect, which is really the beginning. So here we have King Saul. And as we kind of conclude our thoughts for the first class, King Saul has perished. But who is now prepared, anointed, and able to be king over Israel? Well, you have David. And God had to show the children of Israel that when you look for a king, when you look for a king, what aren't you supposed to look at? The outside. Look at the inside. Did Samuel go through this? He did, didn't he? When he comes before David's brothers, every single one he says, "This is it. This is the king. Look at this guy." And then the youngest comes in. And that's the man whom God had chosen long before Samuel even got there. And so, brothers and sisters, the book of 1 Samuel comes to an end. Saul's kingship, Saul's life, also has come to an end. So as we progress this morning in our second class, we'll be taking a look at another headless of 1 Samuel.